I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The new book from Danielle Martin is a great way to think about how Canadians get their health care and how the system can be improved. The book is called Better Now, Six Big Ideas to Improve Health Care for All Canadians. In it, Dr. Martin offers ideas worth exploring that she feels would make the system better and perhaps better attentive to the health of Canadians. The six ideas include making sure Canadians have regular access to a family doctor or primary care provider, bringing prescription drugs under Medicare, reducing unnecessary tests and interventions, reorganizing delivery to increase quality and reduce wait times, implementing a basic income guarantee to alleviate poverty, and bringing local innovation to a national level. I'll get Dr. Martin, who joins me now, to explore these ideas and gauge the willingness of the public and politicians in looking into discussing these ideas. Danielle Martin is a family physician in Toronto and Vice President of Medical Affairs and Health System Solutions at Women's College Hospital. She teaches at the University of Toronto. Video of her 2014 appearance before a U.S. congressional committee in Washington has been viewed millions of times and has increased her profile in this country and beyond as a leading voice in the debate over the future of healthcare in Canada. The book is published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Danielle Martin. Dr. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What drew you to a career in medicine?
Well, I think I've always, in terms of my family background, this is something I talk about in the book. We've always talked about in my family the importance of health and health care, and particularly the importance of ensuring that people get access to health care who really need it. My own family story is one of people not being able to access health care when they required it. When my family came to Canada in the early 50s, my grandfather developed a heart condition. And unfortunately, by the time he died, this was in the days pre-Medicare, my family was essentially bankrupted. And so I grew up around that story and with a very acute sense of the importance of people being able to access health care on the basis of need, not ability to pay. And I do think, although that's not the entirety of the reason, it's certainly a big part of the reason that shaped my desire to pursue a career in medicine.
Yeah, you tell the story, as you said, at the beginning of the book about the experience that not only your grandfather went through in terms of his health, but how that affected the whole family.
And I think that's always true. I mean, it's something I see in my own practice as a family doctor, how it's very rare that just one person gets sick. You know, there are ripple effects of every person's illness across the whole of their family and sometimes even beyond that. And so we do need to think about the impact more broadly than just the individual.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to read your grandfather's story, because, as you said, it's the days before Medicare in Canada. And, there's generations after that who don't know what they didn't have, you know what I mean?
That's right. But you know where we're seeing it now, I mean, I find this fascinating, is in the debate about health insurance in the U.S.
Mm.
So we saw, just this week, of course, Donald Trump signing the first set of papers that will eventually, it seems, lead to the repeal of Obamacare. And whatever people think about the details of that reform, the reality is that when the act is eventually repealed, 20 million people stand to lose their health insurance completely. And so, we often think in Canada, well, that was a time in the past, that's not a problem that we need to worry about anymore. But I don't think it's something that we can ever take for granted. And every day that I work in the healthcare system as a doctor, I'm grateful for the fact that I don't need to worry for my patients about whether they have insurance that's going to cover the cost of their hospital stay or their cost of their visit with me. And now, having said all of that, of course, there's lots to be grateful for and lots to celebrate. We still have a lot of problems in the Canadian healthcare system, and there's a lot that needs to be improved. And that's why I wrote this book, is because I was so affected by the stories of the people in my own practice, stories that I think all of us can see ourselves in and our own family members in, and the problems and challenges that people encounter in the Canadian healthcare system. And I wanted to give a voice to those stories and put forward some constructive suggestions for how to address those challenges.
Is the way things are with the healthcare system in Canada, is that untenable, say, going down the line 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now?
Well, I think it depends on what we mean by untenable. I mean, of course, if we have the same healthcare system and it doesn't change and it doesn't adapt to new technologies and new treatments and new ways of doing things, then it's untenable in the sense that we'll have missed an opportunity to actually make people healthier and to lower healthcare costs. I don't think that it's untenable in the way that word is sometimes used. People talk about the sustainability of the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. You know, we always say that the healthcare system is as sustainable as we want it to be. And what's untenable or unsustainable is putting individuals in a situation where they have to pay for their own care because no individual can ever afford the cost of, almost no individual can afford the cost of a catastrophic health event. But if you look, for example, at prescription medicines, mm-hmm. and this is a problem I see in my practice and I talk about in the book, we now know that 1 in 5 Canadian households reports that someone in that household is not taking their medication because of concerns about costs. So unlike doctors and hospitals, which we brought under Medicare since the 1960s, mm-hmm. there are millions of Canadians who are on their own when it comes to paying for their prescription medicines or trying to figure out how they're going to pay the co-payments or the deductibles for their insurance plans. Now, that's something that really is untenable because it's extremely expensive and the cost of drugs is only rising. So there's an area where we definitely need to be doing better in the Canadian healthcare system, and I put forward some solutions to that in the book.
Where else have they got a universal healthcare system and they have included prescription drugs as part of that?
Well, in fact, every single developed country in the world that has a universal healthcare system includes prescription medicines except for Canada. So whether you're talking about France or Germany, whether you're talking about the United Kingdom or Australia or New Zealand, literally every single one of those countries that has a universal health plan of some kind includes prescription medicines. We're the last one. And I think we sometimes forget because we're often so quick to compare ourselves to the U.S., that there's a whole world out there of other countries that have figured out how to strike a better balance than we have in making sure that people can access their medicines. And I see the impact of that on my patients in my practice. I talk in the book about a taxi driver in my practice in downtown Toronto who I call Ahmed, who's got 3 kids. He's got a beautiful wife. He's a real family guy. And he's got diabetes. He's got high blood pressure. He's got a bunch of different health problems. And he makes the same choice that I think we would all make when it comes to how he's going to spend his money when things are tight at the end of the month. He pays his rent, he pays for food for his family, and when it's a tight month, he doesn't buy his medicine, or he takes it every other day, or he splits his pills, or he runs out and waits a couple of weeks to refill his prescription. And when I think about the impact of that on his health, you know, he's at risk over the coming decades of having a stroke or a heart attack as a result of poor control of his diabetes and high blood pressure. And that could be devastating for him and for his family, but it's also devastating for the healthcare system, you know, because those are hugely expensive problems to treat. So we're being, as I say, penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to paying for prescription medicines in the Canadian healthcare system, and it's something we really urgently need to fix.
And you mentioned in the book the story of this couple who, and a lot of us, you know, have, through work, you know, are able to cover most of the costs of prescription drugs through our extended health, if you will. But I mean, there are still premiums. And so you talk about this one person in the book who, even though they have the extended health, I mean, the cost for them annually is still quite high.
That's right. I think many of us make the mistake of thinking, well, I've got insurance through my job, and mm-hmm. so I should be fine. But in fact, so the case you're referring to is a patient of mine who I call Julie, and she is a young mom, 2 kids. She herself is self-employed, but her husband has benefits through his job that cover her. Mm-hmm. And she came into my office one day with sudden onset of blindness in one eye, and over the ensuing number of days, it became clear that she had a new diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. So that's a horrifying thing for someone to have to deal with in her circumstances. But on top of the diagnosis came the realization that the cost of her medicines is $25,000 a year, every year, for the rest of her life. And her husband's drug plan covers 80% of their drug costs. Well, that's great, but they now need to come up with thousands of dollars for their portion every year forever. And that's been, you know, a very significant difficulty, hardship for them to try to figure out where they're going to find that money, how they're going to plan around it. And it was the last thing that she needed to worry about on top of this devastating diagnosis. So these are, you know, these stories that I tell in the book are they're the stories of real people in the healthcare system who really need to have the system adapt to their needs in a way that honors that basic value of fairness that I think all Canadians believe in, but that also modernizes our healthcare system for the present day.
So, you know, when we talk about healthcare, it's always about money, and whether the federal government, the provincial governments spend enough in terms of healthcare. And then you get people saying, well, it should be a multi-payer system where you know, there is some private, you know, that you can, if you have the means, you can jump the queue, if you will. Where do you think the public is in terms of how they'd like to see the system? And I mean, this goes into a point that you make in the book, that not necessarily more money from governments would fix everything.
Yeah, well, I think there are two elements to the argument about multi-payer systems and should people, you know, be paying to jump the queue if they've got the money to do that. The first is that we can let people pay to jump the queue, but we need to be clear what the impact of that is going to be on everybody else, because when a patient jumps the queue, most of the time their doctor jumps the queue with them. And what all the international evidence suggests about this is that when you let people, some wealthy people, pay to get faster access to health care, you make the wait times longer for everybody else. Mm. And so I think that's a problem of grave concern for us in Canada, and I don't think it's actually what Canadians want. Canadians believe in fairness when it comes to accessing health care services. They just want to know that when they need it, the system is going to be there for them. They want to know that they're not going to have to wait an inordinate or unreasonable period of time. Most of us are even prepared to accept some amount of waiting for non-urgent problems, as long as we know that we're going to be seen in a reasonable period of time and it's not going to affect our ability to live our lives fully. And that is a perfectly reasonable expectation of the healthcare system, and it's something that we can live up to. And in fact, most of the time, we do. Most of the time, for most of the patients, most of the people in the healthcare system, it really does work. But there are things that we could do without spending more money, public or private money, to make the system even more efficient. So I use the example in the book about grocery stores versus banks. You know, when it comes to wait times for specialist care, we basically run the healthcare system like a grocery store. If you go to the store to pick up some milk and some eggs or whatever, you're standing in the lineup, and we all do this kind of dance at the checkout counter where we're trying to figure out which line is moving most quickly, right?
Yeah.
And if you get it right, then you get out quickly, and if you get it wrong, then you're stuck standing in line for an extra 10 minutes.
Right.
That's how we run our specialty healthcare services. Every specialist has his or her own personal private wait list, and nobody knows most of the time how long anybody's wait list is, and you might have a newly graduated specialist with a 2-week wait time in an office next door to a specialist who's been in practice 20 years who's got a 3-month wait time, and nobody knows, and those people are offering essentially the same service. So what we need to do instead is to run the specialty services the way we run the bank, which is you go and you stand in a single lineup and you get served by the next available teller.
Mm.
And in our specialty services in Canada, when doctors have come together like that to share wait lists and centralize intake, we've seen dramatic reductions in the wait times for care without spending any more money, public or private, just by reorganizing the resources that we have in the system. And I call that in the book, it's my big idea number 4, doing more with less. It's about reorganizing the available resources to be more efficient and provide better care to more people faster.
So what's the real impediment to getting there? I mean,
that's the million-dollar question, right? Because so much of what we need to do, nothing is stopping us from doing it. It's not about, you know, the requirement for more legislation or more regulations or more bureaucracy. We don't need to spend more money, although there are a few places in the healthcare system where we could. But very often, it's mostly about reorganizing, and that requires commitment on the part of physicians and patients and hospital administrators and politicians sometimes to kind of say, we're going to get up and go to work today and do something different from what we did yesterday and the day before. And that's why for me this book is so, it's so important that this book be read by regular Canadians. It's not written for healthcare policy wonks or providers. It's written for all of us to take a look at how we, what role we might be able to each of us play in trying to advance some of these solutions, because actually there's really nothing stopping us from making most of these changes today if we wanted to do it.
Dr. Martin, what in 2017 might we expect from the provincial and federal government in terms of a health accord? And what do you think that'll mean for getting to address some of these ideas that you talk about in the book?
Well, the watching these health accord negotiations between the provinces and the feds has been interesting, right? Because it is sort of, sadly, the same old debate about dollars and cents, and now, you know, some provinces are signing one-off deals with the federal government. It's not really clear what the national vision is for where we're heading, which I have to say I find pretty disappointing. To me, what happens in the health accord matters less. To be honest, it will will determine how much money gets transferred from the feds to the provinces, and of course, that matters to some degree on the ground. But if we're just putting more money into the system, the way that it currently is, I'm not sure that it's going to buy us the kind of change that I think Canadians want to see. So let's use the example of mental health services, which is something that the federal government has expressed is a priority, which of course we all agree with, and we all want to see better access to mental health services. Well, if we just take, you know, an additional $10 from the government and put it into mental health services, you might get access to a few more services in each of the provinces. But what if we were to take the investment from the federal government and open up access to what we call virtual consultation, so that a psychiatrist or another mental health worker could assess a patient in a rural community via telemedicine? What if we did what are called share care models, where the psychiatrist, instead of seeing the patient, the psychiatrist comes to the family doctor's office, and in an hour, they could provide the family doctor with advice on 10 or 15 patients that the family doctor then can go back and implement those recommendations, thereby freeing up lots of, you know, lots of spots on the waiting list for the psychiatrist's assessment. What if we were to invest that money into more self-care resources like online cognitive behavioral therapy, so that people who have mild to moderate mental illness could get access to those resources and do some of their therapy online? Like, there's a whole world out there of solutions, some of which will cost a little bit of money, but all of which are really more about doing things differently, transforming the way that we deliver health care. And none of that is going to be in the health accord. That's up to the provinces and the local health authorities and local organizations and local physicians and patients to commit to making those changes, to use that money differently than how we used to spend it.
One of the things I've noticed in recent years, is especially living here in Vancouver, is people I encounter, and a great majority of people that I encounter, don't have a family doctor. And we've been hearing the necessity of that for years. Why isn't it getting better in terms of people having access to a family doctor, or, as you write in the book, a primary care
provider? And it is, I mean, that is, it's big idea one in my book for a reason. A relationship with a trusted family doctor is the basis of the entirety of the healthcare system. And when we get that relationship right, when you have that trust and that contact over time and you develop that relationship, it protects health in so many important ways. And yet, there are still too many Canadians that have difficulty accessing a family doctor. The situation in Vancouver is interesting because, you know, 85% of Canadians, when surveyed, will report that they have a family physician, and that number rises to 95% when you ask only those people who have a chronic illness. So, you know, the question is, do we have an undersupply of family doctors, or is it more a distribution problem where people in some communities and some places have more difficulty? Do we need to think differently about the way that we provide those services? What we have found in other parts of the country, and this is a big problem in Canada, by the way, we learn something in one part of the country and then we need to learn it over and over across the rest of the country.
Ten times,
Yeah, so what we found in many other parts of the country is that when family docs come together in groups, they can often provide more services to more people than they can when they're practicing on their own. Mm. And when they come together in groups that also include non-physician healthcare providers like nurses, nurse practitioners, dietitians, pharmacists, yeah. those kinds of what we call interprofessional teams can provide service to a much larger group of people, and in fact, probably higher quality services, especially for people with chronic illness, than an individual family doctor can do. So it may not be that the answer is more family physicians, although there might be some pockets of the system where that's what's needed. Often, again, it may be about reorganizing the way that we deliver the service to think differently about what the role of the doctor should be on a team like that.
So once one has a doctor, a family doctor, are you finding, just in your experience with fellow doctors and patients that see you because they've seen someone else, that there are unnecessary tests and interventions, and perhaps too many of those, both on the part of the doctor over-prescribing, say, or the patient requesting?
Absolutely. It's a great irony of the Canadian healthcare system that at the same time that we have some people who are having a hard time accessing healthcare services, we also have huge amounts of over-doctoring, over-prescribing, over-testing taking place, and that harms millions of Canadians every year. We know, just as an example, that among Canadian seniors, people aged 65 and over, 1 in 5 seniors is prescribed at least one drug on a list of medications that should never be prescribed to people over the age of 65 because the risks outweigh the benefits. So one of the things that I really think is important is that in that relationship between the family doctor or the primary care provider and the patient, that we have conversations about, is this test or this treatment really likely to help me? What are the risks? Is it possible that it will harm me? What would happen if we just did nothing and waited for a while, and start to have a different kind of conversation in order to protect people from the potential harms, because more is not always better when it comes to medicine.
In your own practice, because we all have the internet now, do you have people coming in to see you and saying, well, I've looked this up and I need this, this, and this, and are you able to tell them no?
I have those conversations, and, you know, oftentimes, first of all, sometimes I learn from my patients, and I'm not ashamed to say that, mm-hmm. but oftentimes people come in, and it's not so much I read this, and I want this, and I want that. It's I read this, and does it apply to me?
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you have that trusting relationship with a person that you've developed over months and years and decades, you can say, as the physician, you know, I'm glad you read that. That's really good. Let me explain to you why your situation is different from this, or why this doesn't necessarily apply to you, or what you might not have realized about this website that you printed this stuff off from is that it's funded by the company that produces this drug or whatever that you're coming in asking for. And it can often be the starting point for a really useful educational conversation on both sides. So I think most of us in medicine welcome that conversation with our patients. We're happy to have people who are informed, and the role of the family doc in that situation is to help you interpret from this thing that you've read online how much of it really applies to your specific situation. And, you know, that's why we still need doctors, even when Dr. Google's around, right?
Yeah. Well, we began, you mentioned at the near the top of the interview that what's going on in the United States and the new president's wanting to repeal Obamacare. President Trump is also talking about renegotiating NAFTA. Does that have an effect on, say, our healthcare system and what that'll look like, say, down the line, in a couple years even down the line?
It does indeed, because actually what I think many Canadians don't, and we all know that NAFTA is intended to, you know, make the borders easier for goods and services to cross in both directions. But what many people don't realize is that there are special protections for our healthcare system in NAFTA that make sure that American companies and insurance companies and healthcare corporations can't come into the Canadian healthcare system and demand access to profits inside the Canadian healthcare system. We have special protections because it is such an important social program that Canadians believe in so strongly. Well, if you get rid of NAFTA, that's one thing, but the question is what do we replace it with? And if we replace it with a trade deal that doesn't allow for those kinds of protections for the healthcare sector, then we may well end up in a situation where American corporations can claim that they have a right to come into the Canadian healthcare system and make a profit off of people's sickness here, which is, I think, probably something that most Canadians would not be particularly happy about. So there are so many unanswered questions about what Donald Trump is planning to do when it comes to healthcare in America and NAFTA and trade deals and all the rest, but I do think it's an important thing for Canadians just to watch and be aware of that particular issue.
Yeah, this is a highly readable book, and it's an urgent one, and it's a good place for a lot of us as Canadians to start thinking about these big ideas and what's happening here. I appreciate your time today, Dr. Martin. Congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Better Now, Six Big Ideas to Improve Healthcare for All Canadians. It's published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin. Its author, Dr. Daniel Martin, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.